Good evening and welcome to the third presentation in this our ninth series of talks on Kentucky Live, Southern Culture at its Best, sponsored by the Friends of WKU Libraries and the Kentucky Museum. My name is Brian Coots, and as head of the Department of Library Public Services, I coordinate this series with my absent colleague, Peggy Wright, and with assistance from our webmaster, Haiwong Wan, and our reference coordinator, Brian Carson. Daniel Peach and Christopher McConnell designed our posters, and our technical specialist tonight here taking pictures is Daniel Pauly. Our speaker tonight is a native of Clarksville, Tennessee, where his family has lived for several generations. He recalls that growing up he wanted to be a writer or even a scientist and was most influenced by the books he read, especially science fiction and literature, and the films he saw. He attended public schools in Clarksville and after graduation enrolled at Austin Peay University, majoring in history and biology. After earning a B.S. degree, he entered the graduate school at the University of Missouri, where he received his M.A. in English and Creative Writing. Many years later, he resumed his graduate education at Southern Illinois University, where he earned a Ph.D. in English and American Literature in May of 2010. He presently teaches English composition and technical writing at the Hopkinsville Community College. He says his interest in the Corvette dates from a childhood fascination with automobiles, airplanes, and almost any device that moves. And when not teaching or writing, he enjoys reading and watching motorsports. His first book, The Corvette in Literature and Culture, Symbolic Dimensions of America's Sports Car, was published by McFarland and Company in 2011, and he was telling us over lunch the first printing of that book already entirely sold out. In it, he explores how this distinctly American sports car became a cultural icon. Since last Thursday, November the 3rd, marked the official 100th birthday of the Chevrolet brand, which was founded in 1911 by race car driver, automobile engineer Louis Chevrolet, it's fitting that we welcome Jerry Passon to talk about our love affair with Kentucky's official sports car. Jerry.
Thank you. Let me begin back in the past a little bit. In 1908, you may know that Henry Ford first produced the Model T. Before then, the pace of motion, the pace of movement was regulated by walking, riding horses, or trains. But in this still, this is from John Ford's version of Steinbeck's The Grapes of Wrath, we see the Joad family packing up to travel west to California. The automobile, as one historian said, was more than speed, more than sex. The automobile brought freedom, and that enhanced the freedom, the ability to travel, that expanded the American dream, and brought new opportunities with it. What we see today, though, is a little different than this. This automobility has become something that we take for granted. We forget the freedom that was given to us and how this has shaped the last 100 years. This automobility is something that as Americans and worldwide, people have come to cherish. Automobility, according to Katie Mills, the author of The Road Story and The Rebel, is composed of autonomy and mobility. That is, it's autonomy meaning we choose to go, and mobility, we have the ability to go. That's what the Corvette represents, and distinctly in a way that we've forgotten that other cars, that all cars once did represent. Also, the cars become a reflection of us. Material cultural studies critic Daniel Miller describes the evident humanity of the car. By that he means that through the automobile, we see a reflection of ourselves. We see aspects of our humanity embodied in our machines. Zora Arkus Duntov, the godfather of the Corvette, said that sports cars are about emotion, not necessarily their physical substance or anything else, but about how they make the drivers, the passengers feel. And this is one of the reasons that the Corvette is in literature and culture. It's how it makes people feel and how it relates to our humanity. One of the first instances of the Corvette we see is this from 1955's film Kiss Me Deadly. Kiss Me Deadly features this Corvette, which replaces a white Jaguar XKE. Kiss Me Deadly 1955 is considered the last of the film noirs, where we get an interpretation of American life, of not necessarily always positive things. In 1955, there were only about 3,000 Corvettes on the road. So the Corvette was a new car, an unusual car. In this film, this is a movie in which some of you may be familiar with, there's a box that contains nuclear material or something nuclear that is a threat to the world. In point of fact, the usual interpretation is at the end of this film, the world ends because the box is opened. The Corvette here is kind of a representation of that technology, the technology of the Cold War, the technology that was threatened. So what we see in the automobile, and particularly in the Corvette, is some of this duality. We see this freedom, this automobility, but we also see a kind of a threat, the danger of the automobile, the danger of technology. The car in this film has a bomb to kill the detective hero, and it has a second bomb because the first one is intended for him to find. So the bombs in the car, the nuclear material, the threat of nuclear war, and this film came out about the same time as the first nuclear monster movies did. One of the major points here is that this is Mike Hammer, Mickey Spillane hero, and he is an aggressive, heterosexual, violent, willing to be cruel. That, coupled with the technology, is the threat to humanity that not just other machines represent. The name Corvette, oddly enough, is never used in this film. In 1955, the car is depicted, we see it, we hear it, but it's not given to us as a name. Perhaps, of course, the Corvette was a new thing. In this film, we see that the patriarchal power that humans cannot separate from destructive self-centeredness, and that will be in the background. Also, critic Mark Osteen, in an essay, Noir's Cars, Automobility and Moral Space in American Film Noir, said that cars became special things at this time. That cars in film noir, and maybe for in other cases, became amoral spaces where laws and social arrangements are suspended. So the car became a thing of freedom in the outside sense of travel. It also became where things could happen, where regular rules or morality may not apply. The Corvette has come to embody some of this. This is a still of the 1967 427 Stingray. This is pretty much the way the ad looks, where the car is very aggressive. It's coming at you, like out of the frame, out of the screen. The hood scoop, what's called a power bulge, the stinger or spear, points to something that is masculine, phallic, where the car becomes something aggressive. Roger N. Casey, the author of Textual Vehicles, said that in the post-war period, America became taken with what he called automania, where cars became exalted machines because they could move and move fast. So the cars become not just transportation, they become representations. Researchers Marsh and Collette, talking about cars, said the fundamental symbolism of the automobile is both complex and inescapable. It conjures up images of speed, excitement, and vitality. Its power and shape endowed with a sense of sexual potency. It is precisely because the car can communicate such a variety of messages that it has captured our imagination. But we know in the case of the Corvette, it's not just the physical car, it's the car's image, that projection of power, of sexuality, of a number of things that have perpetuated, that have kept it going. The Corvette also suggests affluence. This is a picture of a fifth generation Corvette. The house in the background, everything suggests that the car is a possession of someone with some financial ability. Also, the car's shape suggests form. There's this curious thing about automobiles. And often when sports cars are talked about, their shapes or forms are discussed as almost in feminine terms, but we use masculine terms to talk about their power, their engines. So we get this curious thing for the automobile, even though we talk about it as perhaps female, it has male characteristics. If the car is an icon, historian Marshall Fishwick said that icons, like the Corvette, objectify the deep mythological structure of reality, revealing basic needs which go from age to age, media to media, generation to generation. So if the Corvette is the icon, like General Motors says it is, it's carrying a meaning across generations. And some of what I've just said about power, particularly maybe masculinity, and sexuality, are some of those characteristics, some of those iconic values. One of the reasons that the Corvette is this symbol, this icon, came to us in 1960. The Grapes of Wrath gave us the Jode family, their movement from Oklahoma to California. Another book that I would pair with that in terms of automobility is Kerouac's On the Road. What Kerouac's On the Road suggested, or he believes suggested, was a television series, Route 66. Route 66, you saw most of the seasons, Corvettes very much like this one, the original Corvettes. And this appeal, this linking freedom of adventure of the open road and the male drivers of the car, figured into something that one automotive journalist called the freedom of mobility must define our post-industrial identity. It is this desire for independence and autonomy, a sort of unending restlessness that finds us pushed ever westward. And that restlessness is one of the things, that quest for adventure, for new things, for where the road takes us, that has made the Corvette's image what it is. It's not a matter of sitting still, it's a matter of automobility means going places, finding things. The Corvette suggests those things in part because Route 66 featured the car. Route 66 also debuted at just about the right time. Its very first episode premiered on October 1st of 1960, after the Nixon-Kennedy debates. So we had the enthusiasm of that time, we had the optimism of that time within the context of the Cold War, and a car that came to embody some of that, a car that was came along at the right time. Also, the Corvette was the chosen vehicle, the preferred vehicle of the astronauts. First the Mercury, then the Gemini and Apollo astronauts, that many of them owned Corvettes, drove Corvettes, raced each other in their Corvettes. So we had this connection with technology, manhood, America's heroes, the astronauts. Also, this is a racing Corvette from the 1960s. This is, I believe it's a 65 Stingray with fender flares, a power bulge. These cars, or Corvettes like this one, first started racing at Le Mans in 1960, the same year that Route 66 came along. So we had the car being promoted on television in terms of sports, particularly to enthusiasts, and not just in America, but also because the cars competed in Europe, worldwide. So we had an image building at home and overseas. And the Corvette is a brand that's recognized worldwide. In point of fact, I understand that Corvettes in Europe are not sold in Chevrolet dealerships, which we do not have, but they are sold through like Corvette dealerships with Cadillacs. The Corvette has become a brand all of its own. The car's identity is sufficient where it doesn't need to be associated in the eyes of many people with Chevrolet. It's kind of gone beyond that. One of the things that's pointed out is that this restlessness I mentioned before takes a variety of forms in American culture, like we see it in automobile racing. And according to some critics, that this restlessness is our most distinguished national characteristic. And the automobile signifies this need to go places and do things and to be in motion. For Corvette owners, for people Corvette enthusiasts, there's a lot of emphasis on taking their Corvettes places. The Corvette Museum sponsors caravans and tours where the drivers, the owners, get to interact with their cars, to take their cars places. The Corvette's not simply this car then, this physical thing, like we see with the race cars, it's that image of adventure, of freedom, that Route 66 and other things have given us. And that's one of the reasons Corvette has survived for over 50 years. Also, there is what I'm going to choose to call a romance with the Corvette, particularly with men, or often with men, that the car's speed and power, the danger, the excitement of driving, potentially, persist and make it alluring. That's part of what is the Corvette's attractiveness. Is a little bit of an element of excitement or even danger. The racing Corvettes, if you read what the racing teams tell us, they're proud to mention that all the Corvettes have some connection with Corvette racing cars. Not just a name connection, but they have mechanical connections, they have styling connections. So that all Corvettes partake of this excitement. What Mark Osteen talked about in his essay on noir cars, cars in film noir, he said that there was an aspect that he called convertibility about the automobile. that the automobile did have those characteristics, like I've said, but in particular, open cars had that. Roadsters, convertibles, particularly opened you out to the world. That openness to the world also involved a danger, a kind of a jeopardy, like automobile racing, where you were exposed to things. So in the sense of that, keep in mind that the original Corvettes, like the one I just showed you, were designed as open cars. They didn't have a roof, or they had a removable hard top, or they just had the fabric top. That all Corvettes were open cars. And even though the Stingrays were both closed coupes and convertibles, the Corvette by design has always kept that kind of open car convertibility, that exposure to things, that involvement with driving, with road, with travel. Today's Corvettes, the latest ones, even the hardtop coupes, for the most part, still have removable roof sections. So all Corvettes partake of this open carness, this involvement in the world, this involvement in the experience of driving, where so many cars are closed or isolated, the Corvette is open. Even when it's a closed car, it still carries that aura, that openness in what it represents. One of the things about the Corvette that I found and I've noticed, this is about a 1995 ZR1 Corvette. At the time, it was the fastest Corvette produced. The most powerful models had a little over 400 horsepower. They set speed records. These cars led to these, which are the current Corvettes. The current Corvettes, if the ZR1s, that ZR1, produced at most 400 horsepower, this standard Corvette today has 430. So we're talking about an evolution in terms of power. The Corvette name carries this idea of power, of speed. That power can metaphorically then be the power of the owner, of the driver, of the person who has the Corvette. And that's one of the associations we make here, for that humanity of the car is, if I own a Corvette, perhaps I borrow some of the Corvette's strength, the Corvette's power. The Corvette's, if we want to talk about it in terms of masculinity, potency. Now, there are several films in which minorities, people who are thought of as disadvantaged, become Corvette owners, Corvette drivers. Particularly, African-American males use Corvettes. And some writers interpret this, or interpret this as an inconsistency with, an excess of masculinity, of people who have been deprived of power, using something to be more powerful, to make up for a lack in the past or proceed in the present through the machine. Wesley Snipes in Passenger 57 drives a red Corvette convertible. In Rush Hour, Chris Tucker drives a black 1970 convertible. In Showtime, Eddie Murphy has a silver coupe. In the movie Pootie Tang, which you may not have seen, that's the character's name, Pootie Tang, who speaks jives that people can understand, but you never know what he's saying, he has a baby blue convertible. And the film at one point even goes so far as to have him driving down the road, and he gets kind of out from behind the wheel and starts to strike poses, like from Vogue magazine or Gentleman's Quarterly, behind the wheel of the car. And the car seems to be driving itself down the road as he's doing all of this. Expressions of style, of manliness. The film, the more recent film that you may be aware of, 7 Pounds, the Will Smith movie, you don't see it too often, but he drives a Stingray. He drives a Stingray very much like this car. And it's the accident driving the car, a little momentary lapse of control that costs him not his life, but certainly maybe you could say the vitality of his life, and it kills 7 people. The car then, while it provides masculinity or even an excess of masculinity, and it involves technology like the space program, it does carry with it that element of danger. And you remember, these cars are the Stingrays, in that film, that he has an interest in a particular jellyfish, a stinging fish that he uses, to spoil the movie for you, to kill himself. Jellyfish, Stingray. Both things that involve stinging, that involve perhaps danger. So the car carries, like the car we saw from Kiss Me Deadly, the black Corvette with a very predatory or shark-like nose, the car carries an element of danger too. And we know today that the automobile is not just automobility today, but we know there's dangers to the environment. We know that there's accidents, a highway death. We know that the car now, in our time, is perceived as a mixed kind of blessing. Some people look at the Corvette, or some depictions of the Corvette suggest this kind of double face. Or in looking at the literature of it, you see that where in some cases the Corvette is a good thing, the hero's vehicle, the hero's car, expressing maybe power in this case. But it also can be that dangerous thing, if we look at it, this picture another way, that threatening thing. Because if the Corvette represents not just the Corvette, but other cars, cars in general, then what we see in terms of the Corvette is what all cars used to be. But now we're aware of both the positives, the automobility, the freedom, and the dangers. The road is a dangerous place. That convertibility means exposing ourselves to things that may be harmful. Adventure carries with it danger. One of the important things here that I want to mention, that the Corvette for many people suggests controlled power that helps define masculinity. Owning the car means to possess that assurance of power and identity that enables the characters to act. If not to act as men, then to act as creatures that are empowered. Furthermore, Paul Gilroy, the author of The Black Atlantic, who you may be familiar with, talked about that there was identification, a relationship between things, not just automobiles, although he's a critic of the automobile, but a relationship between identity and property. If we look at the Corvette then, what we see is this tangible object, but also an image. And how many of us think of the Corvette and respond to the image? When we do that, we do so emotionally. And for many owners or drivers, the connections they make with the car are one of personal identity with something that's real and physical and tangible, where the object and the object's image become personal, become internal, where the car is an extension of oneself. And if oneself is not as strong, as masculine, as powerful, then the car is something that fortifies that, that enhances that. If this 400 horsepower Corvette is one of the most powerful cars, and I'm driving one, how would I feel? Powerful. One of the things is that the Corvette is no longer just a province of men. That masculinity in this case does not necessarily mean men only. What we find in literature, what we find in films, in culture, is women becoming involved with the Corvette. And if you look at the Corvette's history, you see some of this, although it's not as prominent maybe as the men who are part of it. This is a 1956 Corvette. 56 was important for a couple of reasons. 56, there was a little bit of restyling of the Corvette, most noticeably what you might call the Corvette DNA, Corvette characteristics. This shape, this inset, this cove, is one of the distinction characteristics of Corvettes from this time on. There's a scoop, there's an inset here, and this is a styling device. Here we have a red car. This one is kind of orangey. Some popular depictions, you see this color scheme where it's very vivid red. You see the red and the white. And with a blue background, then you have red, white, and blue American colors. The woman here is somebody important. This is Betty Skelton. Betty Skelton was an aviator, or aviatrix, as they might say, a pilot. She set speed records driving cars, Corvettes among them. She also, so authorities tell us, took, or I should say not took, but qualified for astronaut training with like some of the original astronauts. She wasn't allowed to be one. She was a woman. They were all white males. But she passed those things, and Chevrolet called upon her be one of the people featured in Corvette ads. Now, she was female, very attractive. You see some poses of her with Corvettes, like you might see with swimsuit models, except in at least one of these poses, she's wearing more like a flight suit, because she was a pilot. This Corvette also is the one that kind of sets a pattern, because with 56, we get these changes. Like I said, the coves. You notice the back of the car, this, the four tail lights. I know a lot of cars have four taillights, but Corvette's four taillights are part of its culture. It's that DNA. This is a Corvette signature. The four taillights, notice even in here in this fifth generation car, you see there's still a scoop in the side. You don't see it too well in here. You see it here in the newer one. You see the power bulge in the hood, which suggests that power, the power of the engine. Here we've got that cove treatment again.
One other thing I ought to mention, this car was kind of controversial when it came out because it redid some of that Corvette appearance. The original Corvettes all had fixed headlights. But the Stingray, starting in 1963, had hideaway headlights, retractable headlights. This car, some Corvette fans didn't like it because it went back to exposed headlights. It went back to that original Corvette signature. So we look at a Corvette, we're seeing signatures of headlights, the coves, the four tail lights, the power bulge hood,
a number of factors. So the car does have a kind of a DNA. The car has an identity because of these signatures. And while many cars have this, the Corvette is that example, that tip of the iceberg, where what it represents as a car is what all cars, in a way, really has a significance of, but they become like refrigerators or toasters to us. One reason this is important, one of the people that was least empowered, like I said, was women. Yet what we see often is how women use Corvettes. Much of the time, the car and the freedom to move, as the Corvette comes to signify, are predicated on being male or possessing the attributes of masculinity. This was a limiting factor for female human beings. Autonomy and mobility were often denied to women, and mobility was not considered a natural characteristic of women. You know the movie director, the movie pioneer, D.W. Griffith? D.W. Griffith said at some point that men moved, but women stayed still. And that was a stereotypical but notion that we sometimes see, that women are not supposed to be moving. Yet, Betty Skelton, women were quite capable of moving. And some depictions of the Corvette, some uses of the Corvette, involve women driving. Women become powerful or claiming some kind of identity through their cars. And the Corvette's one good example. You know what movie this is from.
Thelma and Louise.
You know what car this is? It's supposed to be a turquoise 66 Thunderbird convertible.
Okay, I don't see a Corvette in this picture.
Originally, in the 50s, the Corvette and the Thunderbird were rivals. Particularly the early Thunderbirds, the later cars, they weren't quite so sporty. But at one point, early in the Corvette's life, in about late 1954, there were 300 Corvettes made the first year. The second year in 53 and 54, there were something like four, only like 2,700 sold. The Corvette wasn't selling and GM was considering killing it. They fixed that shortly thereafter. One of the reasons, if you look in the history of the Corvette, one of the things they said is the Thunderbird saved the Corvette. Because GM, Chevrolet, looked at Ford and looked at the sales of the Thunderbird and they said, if this car is selling, we need to fix the Corvette and it'll sell too. And the fellow I mentioned earlier, Zoroarkus Dantov, the European-American of Russian descent, he had raced sports cars. He had helped engineer sports cars in Europe. He came over, joined Chevrolet, and he wrote a letter to the corporate management at GM. And this was during the time of the baby boomers who were becoming old enough to be drivers. And he wrote and said, there's this interest in cars, particularly fast cars, hot rods in America. Sports cars are part of that. He said, if we want the Corvette to succeed, it's got to be better. It's got to be sporty. And in 1955, the Corvette got a V8 engine for the first time. And that's one of the other DNA things about the Corvette, its identity. It's a V8 car, V8 powered, a distinctly American V8. In Thelma and Louise, we have these women who are disempowered, who don't have power. In the course of the film, they rebel against this patriarchal culture, this masculinity. In the course of that rebellion, they acquire identity. The screenwriter for Thelma and Louise, Kelly Curry, talked about women acquiring power. In this case, automobility is power. And where are they going in here? They are going westward, kind of like characters in On the Road so often went westward, only to return east. But Kelly Curry, who won the Academy Award for this screenplay, said that Thelma and Louise were like Edna in Kate Chopin's novella, The Awakening. The characters come to realize their full identities as female human beings, but society and the culture they live in will not permit them to further develop or utilize their abilities. So they're rebelling against that, breaking free in the Thunderbird. Curry went on to say, if women become truly whole, completely who they are, true to themselves in every way, complete, self-determined, and self-defined, then the world might not be big enough to hold them. Certainly not the way it is now. What they're breaking free of, in a way, is that negative for that masculinity, that patriarchal culture that some people see in the Corvette rather than freedom. You know, the Corvette in Thelma and Louise, the red one, belongs to Thelma's husband. You see it parked outside in one or two scenes. You see him wear a gold neck chain that says V1. You see the license plate on his Corvette is V1, meaning not like power for everyone, not like power for women, but power for me, for men. In this movie, the Corvette, kind of that dark side of the Corvette, becomes that instrument, that sign, signifier of patriarchal culture. It suggests something to be rebelled against, something negative, if not evil, something dominating. And that's part of the thing, the reason why the Corvette in literature and culture is we don't see just this one aspect of a car, we see a range of aspects of the car, where it can be technology, it can be masculinity, in some cases evil, in some cases benevolent. You familiar with Joan Didion's Play It As It Lays from 1970? This is a still from the movie. This is Mariah Wyeth, played by Tuesday Weld. This is her Corvette and a California State Trooper. This is her car pulled over the side of the road. Mariah is an actress. She is in the Hollywood of the late 60s, where Didion herself lived. Someone without power. Her husband's a movie director, but she herself spends most of her time actually driving on the road. In the context of the novel, it tells us that she drives 7,000 miles a month, which works out to 4 or 5 hours a day on the road. What Mariah does, or what the Corvette becomes for her, is this kind of instrument of positive identity, of empowerment, because the only place she feels any kind of freedom, that she feels in the least bit in control, is on the road. That control is power. That what we talk about here in terms of not just the car is the ability to drive, to own the car, to operate it. Particularly, maybe this is important in California, where this takes place. Rainer Badham, the British architect and critic, came to L.A., or went to L.A., without knowing how to drive. And he learned to drive, he said, so that he could read the culture of L.A. And in his words, he said, as you acquire the special skills involved, the freeways become a special way of being alive. The extreme concentration required in Los Angeles seems to bring on a heightened sense of awareness. Which is pretty much what Mariah describes driving her Corvette. She eats driving the Corvette, cracks hard-boiled eggs on the steering wheel. She files her nails. She drives the car barefoot, like it's an intimate relationship with the car. The car is, in a way, the most positive relationship she has. Cleopatra Jones, from the 1973 black exploitation film, made the same year as Pam Grier's Coffee. Cleopatra Jones is 6'2", she's got karate, weapons and everything. Her car is a black customized Stingray. She is a female action hero. The Corvette has guns hidden in it and a number of things. But here we get not just this male hero driving a Corvette, this man who is alluring to the women. We get the attractive, the strong, powerful female. She's a CIA agent. And her car, black with silver trim. So now, instead of this business where we talk about the woman being disempowered, the Corvette suggests power. Suggests some kind of, in a way, even independence, because she's in charge here. She's the one who gives the orders that the other people follow. As one person wrote, driving a Corvette is not just driving any automobile. The car's image, its physical power, and its associations with affluence and sexuality make it a statement about one's self. By driving a Corvette, a woman asserts her identity, an effective difference that emphasizes the body's positivity, positive nature of being female. I propose that for women who own and drive Corvettes, the experience is different than for men. That for men, sometimes in this so-called masculine culture, which is really not about gender, it's about power, there's a certain empowerment taken for granted by men. Almost like the Corvette is what we should have. It's what we deserve. For women, though, the Corvette is something more of an extension. It is something more of an acquisition, of a positive affirmation of an identity that may have been lacking.
And when we see Cleopatra Jones in this movie, we see Mariah here with her car, we see women who are in a way more empowered. You can't tell it from this picture, but Mariah stopped by the side of the road not because her Corvette is broken down, not because there's any problem. She is changing the tire, the driver's side tire, which we cannot see. And she's not doing it because it's flat. When this police officer, he's uncredited, it doesn't tell us who the actor is, and knows he's the far side of the fence, like there's something between them. When he asks her why, or he offers to call like a tow truck for help, she says, no, don't. She says her father taught her how to change the wheel, and she enjoys doing it. And about being on the freeway, she says, I like it out here. She won't sleep in the house at home because she associates plumbing with the abortion she had and the abortionist watching the remains of the fetus down the drain. The air conditioner in the house, she associates the air conditioner with the air conditioner that was running while the abortion was she associates all these things about home, about house, that women are acquainted with as negatives. Where she's at home, though, where she's strong, is in her Corvette. And her child, she has an aborted child, she has a living child who is, I suppose we would say, autistic. The novel says she has an aberrant chemical in her brain where her daughter cannot interact with her, does not interact with her.
The relationship that develops with the car
is a relationship that gives her some kind of identity, some kind of power. Women with Corvettes are women with identity. Men with Corvettes sometimes are men with power, but for a woman, the car, not just the Corvette, but maybe any car, means a measure of independence that may not have been granted to them always. Remember I talked about the Stingray before? If we talk about the car as art, if we talk about Corvettes might be art.
If we're concerned what, if this physical thing, this utilitarian object can be art,
this is one of the cars that we probably talked about, or this is one of the few American cars, some people say the only American car that's talked about,
the 63 through 67 Corvette Stingrays. This car is a 63. This is a unique car.
If you own one of these, you own something that does not exist anywhere else.
The cars were made for 5 years.
You saw the picture of the 67 with the hood bulging and so on,
but only this 1 year
was the split rear window. These cars are unique, they're rare, they're collectible, they're works of art, there's so many, only so many of them. Automobile Magazine in 2004 did a survey of its readers, you know, who are automobile enthusiasts, not all male, maybe majority male, and the car that was chosen, the coolest car, not just the coolest American car, but the coolest car, up against like the Jaguar XKE, one of this car's rivals, up against
Porsche 911,
was this Stingray. The 63 through 67 Stingrays were chosen the coolest car. There was a list of 100 cars.
This is the car, if you say to me, some people like me, a Corvette, we think of Stingray.
And I should point out when I say Stingray that there's two Stingrays. There's this kind of Stingray, Stingray, two names, and later that name was revived in the 60s for the next generation, and Stingray, one word. So right away there's confusion of identity there, but when you say Stingray, two words, you mean this car, which is kind of art. Or, the Corvette is a machine and a name with associative power and material existence. It is already a subject of numerous photographs, as well as being used in a variety of creative contexts, some of the books I've mentioned, to suggest a range of ideas. The form of the automobile, the automobiles themselves, the Corvette and other cars, their beauty and clarity of style is a subject of some intense artistic intention. Roland Barthes, in his essay, The New Citroen, in 1972, wrote about automobiles, not about Stingrays, but about automobiles in general, and he said that automobiles were a great creation of the age, modern time, passionately conceived, consumed in its image, if not in its use, by a whole people who appropriate it as a perfectly magical object. So cars, or some cars, are magical objects that have power. This is a Tal design in 2003, built this show car called the Moray. It's a custom car. You notice it's got that kind of Italian flow of line, right? Notice you could consider that line feminine if you wanted to, that curvaceous shape. Well, this car has a 400 horsepower V8 engine, so it's powerful too. So it's got that business of both power, masculinity if we want to call it that, and style, which if they're in good balance we might consider art. Why does it say 50 here?
This car is actually the chassis is a 2002-2003 Corvette.
Ital Design did custom work on it, rebodied it as an homage,
as a tribute to the Corvette on its 50th birthday. This is the Corvette Moray.
The body designed and built in Italy
after the Corvette, after the American car.
So far as I understand, it's only the one of these. This is a bubble top that comes off. The 50 means that 50th anniversary. We've got a wing like the Corvette race car. We saw a Corvette race car. So it's got like a Corvette race car wing. It's got the side exhausts that were popular in the 60s. It's got these gills which echo the coves. So we got all this Corvette stuff going on. And if you look at this car, if you look at the Moray, and then you look back to this car, are there some similarities? Does the nose of this kind of look like that? I'm not saying absolutely, but is there a resemblance? So the Moray looks like a Corvette, even though it was made in Italy. The sixth generation Corvette still has that same identity. The cars have an identity, even though there's six different body styles, six different forms. There's like a concept here. Is the Corvette art? Difficult to say. But in the essay, The Automobile and Art, from the book Automobile and Culture, art historian Gerald Silk writes, "The automobile, one of the great modern inventions, has become a major attraction in museums of history, technology, and transportation. As objects of potential beauty and aesthetic significance, motor cars are exhibited in the design sections of art museums." Not all cars, but some. "But as imagery and subject matter in the works of art, the automobile appeared in museums and galleries long before that there were cars on display in the 30s. So is the Corvette art? Conclusion? You know what this car is? This is one of the most famous Corvettes, not for good reasons to some of us. This is the Corvette Summer Car from 1978. That's Mark Hamill,
Luke Skywalker, and Annie Potts, designing one.
In the context of the movie, this is a wrecked car that this fellow, who's a teenage shop student, and his friends rebuild into this.
I have seen this car. I've been to the museum with this car. I've seen it. Remember, in 78 was not a good time for Corvettes. It was not a good time for American cars in general. Performance was down. There was concern about emissions and so on. So instead of maybe the power under the hood, we get the body. I would say the overdone body.
The headlights, the exaggerated nose, the exaggerated side pipes.
You may not be able to tell.
There's the steering wheel.
You notice what's wrong? It's on the right side. It's made to be like a European sports car or a British sports car. Some European car. The steering wheel is on the right. It's so customized. It's so different. It's an outrageous car, but it's an outrageous car when the Corvettes, the normal Corvettes, didn't have 400 horsepower. It's a car that transforms the Corvette becoming mundane into something that's once again art. The design of the Corvette evokes a range of emotions. If we think of the car as sculpture, the mass of an automobile may create a pleasing, even startling impression. If the form it takes shapes material in a way that is pleasing to the eye and the touch, then it does approach aesthetic art. Remember, cars aren't just seen from the outside. We sit in them and we drive them. The Corvette is not just a pleasing exterior. It is also an enclosing, enveloping space where it becomes a functional part of the mechanism. I may not have made a perfect case for the Corvette as art, but I want to end with saying this, and we're talking about the Corvette as art, but we're talking about the Corvette in general and all the things I've tried to cover. Stephen Bailey, the British design and culture critic, in his book Cars, Freedom, Style, Sex, Power, Motion, Color, Everything, writes, "And car design is one of the distinctive, even defining art forms of the 21st century. Roland Barthes said that cars were like the great Gothic cathedrals. Bailey says they were the defining art forms of our century. Great cars are, with pop and the media, our age's singular contribution to cultural history. Nothing has more passion, expertise, and cunning put into its design." The Corvette is to be found in literature and culture because it involves automobility. It talks about sexuality. Freedom for not just anybody, not just males, but for females, for people of any culture, anyone who can get behind the wheel of one. The Corvette is a car with an identity. It's not just this physical car, it's also the image of the car that gets transformed, that has really not just one identity. There's six generations, soon to be a seventh in about 2 years. It's not a car with six or seven identities. It has a different identity depending on where you find it and who's using it, who's looking at it.
There's other things that do this too, but in terms of the world of cars, maybe particularly American cars, I think the Corvette's it. Thank you.
Questions?
Yes.
I love your design and gender analysis. I'm wondering if you looked at class at all, because I've always been very curious why a car that is so beautifully designed and so expensive remains in blue collar workers than it does old money or upper class.
Well, the Corvette was always kind of expensive. Not as expensive as like maybe some of his competition, the European competition, though. Like a Jaguar XKE, which during the 60s was the competition, and now it's probably the Porsche 911. What the Corvette has always tried to do, what the fans of the Corvettes, what General Motors, they talk about affordable, like an affordable exotic car. Yes, it's an expensive car, but if you look at it from the other side, it's affordable. It has the power or the performance of a Ferrari, of a Porsche. But it has a price that's a little high, but it falls in the middle. I didn't mention it. I didn't play the music. I meant to play the music. Remember Dead Man's Curve, Jan and Dean? A class reading of that would be you've got the XKE, the European car, the expensive exotic car. Then you've got the more, maybe middle class, working class American Corvette. You can read the Corvette as, yes, expensive, but not exotic expense. It's that idea of affordable power. Power that's accessible, maybe not to everyone, but to most people or to a wider range of people than like Ferraris, Porsches, or Jaguars.
But that's part of it. That's Porsche that has the name Corvette. Some people use it Chevrolet. And I don't think we'll ever get out from that.
Well, but in Europe and in Japan, and I think even in Australia, there is no such thing as a Chevrolet Corvette. There's just Corvette.
Is she talking about Europeans? Why are you talking about your fellow Americans?
I guess anybody, yeah. I guess the way you say it seems attainable, but more for the everyman.
How many Corvettes do you see in Beverly Hills, and how many Porsche 911s?
More than it used to.
Well, yes, because the Corvette has moved to compete more and more with those some of the latest versions.
And it's a better car, too.
And it's a better, the difference between, I would argue, like the Porsche 911 and the Corvette, if you talk about cars with comparable performance, is usually the word refinement is used. Right. European cars are more refined. But then again, they're much more expensive. Does that extra money buy you performance? Not necessarily. Does it buy you refinement? Yes, but less than it used to, less all the time.
It buys you prestige.
Prestige?
Yeah.
What is a name worth?
Got this car,
yes, and that's part of the thing, that the Corvette has prestige, but also has that kind of prestige that's available or affordable. It's kind of striking middle ground by design.
You nobody will appreciate it. Chevrolet needs a blue collar car.
Yeah. We're seeing the Corvette change that with the old money she's talking about. The people that's got the old money are not idiots. They're realizing what kind of bargain the Corvette is. I promise you, they may have a Porsche 911, they may have a Ferrari, they may have a Jaguar, but they've got a Corvette in that garage somewhere.
Yeah.
And you take the old money or the smart money, they're driving that Corvette. The one man we all know could buy any car in the world, Jay Leno, drives a Corvette every day.
He has either five or six in his garage.
He can drive anything.
Some of them customized one at a time.
Okay.
One of the things you commented about it in the book was that we won't get into a debate about the merits of cars here tonight. One of the things you commented about in the book is of all the Corvettes ever produced, most of them are still around.
That was in sometime in the 90s when there were 1,100,000. That according to it's in All Corvettes Are Red, that book. He points out that like 1,100,000. An estimated million are still on the road, still registered, still driving, even if they don't get driven every day. So there's a large number of them, even if they're older Corvettes, that you still see. They're still out there.
Other questions?
So
yes.
What's your favorite design? The Stingray 63 or?
Me speaking personally,
yeah.
I like the 65s. 65, 60, 67. The one I like the most since then is probably today's. Because today's to me seems to have gone back to some of the virtues. It, it,
doesn't look a thing like the Stingrays, but to me it's closer to the Stingrays in terms of idea, in terms of maybe that refinement. Because the Stingrays were, in a way, more refined than we give them credit for sometimes. I would say the original Stingrays, those Stingrays, and today's cars. I like the balance of today's cars. And yet still, I would say, if my income were just a little higher, affordable.
Any further questions?
I do have one other comment. All the reasons that we talk about Corvettes, I love that. I mean, I think it's kind of Corvettes, just plain old-fashioned fun.
Yeah, that's the idea of adventure, of freedom. Part of what freedom means is the ability to enjoy yourself, to have fun. Yeah.
Well, on behalf of our sponsor, Friends Organization, our genial host here at Barnes-Noble, I want to thank Jerry for coming by from Hopkinsville to enlighten us about the Corvette and literature and culture. It's a fascinating book. I encourage you to read it. And I want to thank you people for coming out and joining us in another Kentucky Live. And hope you'll be our guests next February when, again, we'll explore Kentucky culture. Thank you and good evening. We'll be, if you'd like to buy a copy of the book, we have copies up here. And I'm sure we'll put Jerry up here.
And I'll
put it any way you want me to.
He's at the back.